This is Leo for KTWH. It is an overcast and rainy day this Tuesday, August 22nd. Second day of, with some rain in it in the last week, and we can't say that for much of this summer, can we? Maybe are getting a little bit of a wet pattern, and it's changing our view of the world even, to look out at a misty, moisty world. And that's what we do on Wandering Nature News, is look out on the world that the plants and wildlife are experiencing. And I have, not in the studio today, but by special call-in assignment, we have Michaela Rice out there in the ether. Are you there, Michaela?
I have been located.
Your undisclosed location has been revealed. That's good. Good to have you with us. And I know that you've been on the waves in the last 24 hours of our great, great lake. You spent much time in boats in Lake Superior before, Michaela?
No, I have not.
Did you?
Yes. We sit a little bit above the water, and we were just right in the waves yesterday. So yeah, I definitely got to experience that.
So you were tossed about a bit. Okay.
I was, yes. Up and down for hours.
Well, one of our favorite experiences of visiting with you this last summer has been when we got together to talk about loons, the penguins of North America, as it were. And we talked all about the amazing life cycles and physiology and the morphology of those amazing big birds that somehow still fly. We talked them up and down and fascinated a lot of people, but we didn't really talk about what they're maybe most noted for, which is the specifics of their vocalizing, Michaela. So I thought we'd spend a little time on that today. Even though you're not in the studio with me, I've got some recordings of the loon calls that you directed me to look to pay attention to. I did a little research, found some online sources. How do you usually identify or recognize loon vocalizations? Do you categorize them a certain way?
That's a good question. Yes, there are some different characteristics. And before we even dive into the four, I'll give my little introduction to loon vocalizations. I definitely am not claiming to be an expert. As we all know, we're here discussing things that I might have a grasp on biologically and trying to bring them to the attention of the listeners. And this is a case where animal communication in general is all about how we perceive them as humans, right? So we're limited in what we can pick up on and how we can interpret those messages. And many animals communicate through scent or maybe more visual. The loons, as we will learn, are very vocal, and they call most often in the middle of the night from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., and this mostly pertains to the males calling, which I'll talk about. But in general, when you're on a lake, you can tell how loons take advantage of that tone of their voice. It travels really far. So I think they've kind of been able to take advantage of some of these large open spaces for sending messages a far distance. So what I like to think about first is maybe kind of a more simple vocalization, which would be just communicating parents and babies and maybe family members. And this can happen also outside of the mating season. So animals, especially loons, they're very aggressive, territorial animals. When those hormones have calmed down and they're not really full in their mating season yet, or after their mating season, they don't vocalize as much. But this is a call, the hoot, that they do use all the time, I believe, to contact one another.
Well, Michaela, I was able to find few examples of hoots, and maybe you should talk about the fact that there's this wonderful resource out there, I think from the Cornell Ornithology Lab, that is an app on a phone. Now, I wasn't able to use apps on cell phones to gather, you know, the audio files that I gathered for today. They came off of other sites on the internet. So we didn't have access to some of those examples of hoots. So the hoots that I have are pretty subtle, and there's a lot of background noise. You want me to hit you with what I found?
Yes, please.
Okay, let's try that. Ha ha! So that, Michaela, I meshed two recordings together. So it definitely sounds like there are, these are distinct to different birds and different lakes at different times.
Yeah, I could pick up some differences between the sounds, and likely chicks will sound different than their parents too. Just like, I don't know if you've ever listened to young crows or young ravens. They definitely make a lot of different noises than their parents.
Yes.
Where they're trying to imitate the sound of their parents, but they sound different.
Sure.
And I have never heard that many hoots in a row. I've just heard it like one at a time. But maybe that's kind of an intimate setting. Those loons feel calm. They're just trying to look for each other when they're maybe foraging or during their migration.
Well, something that it didn't occur to me till just now, that we talked about how loons are so often having a single birth, but they do have more. They do have two young sometimes in a given year.
Yeah, they lay two eggs. Normally, when animals lay kind of a certain number of eggs, like two, they're limited, pretty limited. I think they will have two eggs every year.
Oh, okay. Did not know that.
Or, you know, once they reach maturity. But I don't think that chick survival is very high. Maybe we're thinking one or two out of those four every 2 years will actually survive into its next year.
The reason I bring it up is thinking that the vocalizations a hoot between the young and its parent might be different than if, I don't know, if the two chicks, the siblings communicate as well, or even that if there's any kind of...
No, they definitely do.
Okay, if some might even be in terms of play or, you know, competition for attention.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those nuances are the ones we don't quite know enough about, because they haven't monitored loons, you know, in those more social or kind of laid-back settings where chicks would feel comfortable enough, you know, doing their day-to-day things being monitored. They probably would need to put like an audio collar or something, a waterproof audio collar on these birds to really learn about their vocalizations every day for a long time.
Do you know?
Maybe in the future.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you know that whether there are longitudinal studies trying to figure out more about what the message is in the calls?
I haven't heard anything, though.
Okay.
Well, that would likely be on the forefront.
Well, what would you...
I know they're doing it with some other animals, but...
What would you like to share with the listeners next? I have three other different call variants that I'm sure that
sure.
you know something about.
Well, we can get into the whale, and this is another call that both parents will use. And then I believe probably once a chick gets old enough, we don't know what that age that they start to use the whale back. But this is more of maybe an encouragement call to leave the nest or come here, I have food. Or come out, you know, it's safe. It sounds like it's more of like an encouraging call instead of just locator, like where are you, or, you know, kind of a Marco Polo kind of thing.
Well, maybe we should hear what I've got.
Play that.
Yeah, maybe we should hear what I've got. And I've got two variants, and one of them is a little on the hyperactive side. So maybe let's hear first the more solo whale that I think we have right here. So what do you think?
Yeah, that's in line with what I've heard. I know I've definitely heard that call out on the lake a few times, more so than the hoot.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be piercing. And because we're talking about sound transmission on water, really reflected and projected, certain frequencies really take off. And I'm curious as to how many, if over a couple of miles, a loon call is capable of being heard. I just don't know how far that might go on a still, quiet night.
Yeah, once you get into the yodel, too, you'll hear how piercing those sounds are as well. And I think those are the ones that travel.
Speaking of calls,
yeah,
your companion animal's calling.
He's alerting me.
Do you want to hear the more hyperactive whales? Just a little bit. You might be intrigued by this, just to know that they're not always as solitary and quiet as that. We have this one.
Oh,
I think it picks up here dramatically at the, a little further on here, Michaela. We've got some background visitors to the loons. I think here they come. Oh, thought we had more whales than that. Sorry about that. Anyway, but you can hear that they're not always the only animal in the soundscape.
Well, sometimes I know specifically with corvids, the crows and the ravens, they're really adept at picking up alarm calls of other animals and using that, you know, to their advantage, interpreting the situation, knowing whether there's a threat or possibly a food source. So I was actually kind of interested that there were some other calls in the background, but we don't know the context. So
exactly.
So the next one is probably a really common, and this is the call that when we ask kids that stop by our nature cart if they can make a call, this is the one that they try because it's known as a laughing call. And this is where my voice would really crack if I tried to do it as well. But this is what they would consider the alarm call. When Zach and I were listening to Dr. Peruk speak, he had mentioned about having loons respond to their capture boats a lot with the tremolo because it is an alarm call. Loons are alerting each other that something is getting too close. I also recently heard it when I was on Seagull Lake, the end of the gunflint, the tremolo as they were flying over kind of pre-dusk. It's almost like they were kind of flying back home to their territory and using this during flight. And it's kind of alarming when you hear it overhead because it's so loud.
Right. My notation looks like I might have a more isolated tremolo, and then I have one I've labeled hyper tremolo. Do you want to hear that succession? Because maybe it'll strike you as to what's happening here.
Sure.
Let's go first with this initial tremolo call of the common loon. We're speaking with Michaela Rice today in a special edition of Wandering Nature News. Heard the water. And then, Michaela, I've got this. Well, somebody seems a lot more alarmed there, don't you think?
Yeah, and it sounds like that's when there's two, probably the mated pair, are both singing. And I'll tell you, my dog was very interested in those noises. He was looking at my phone with his ears perked up. Some sources I saw or called this the night chorus or the flight call. Obviously, the night chorus when the two of them are doing it together.
Yeah.
And I've never heard two loons doing that, I don't think.
Okay.
I could see that being pretty creepy if you're out in the middle of nowhere and you hear that.
Yeah,
at night.
It does seem to sound the alarm. Here's what comes to mind as I remember us talking about the night calls, and you're going to have to remind me, you and Zach referred to a specific calling, or is it singing, that you said was the night census, the who's on the lake vocalization?
Yeah, and I believe that would be the yodel, the last one.
Uh-huh. Oh, good. Well, then that was a timely question. I was waiting to hear what I thought might be. And by census, we mean like it's like everybody calling out that they're present. And this is so that you can ascertain whether you know the players on your lake or are there any new interlopers. Is that kind of the idea? And if so, why would the why would the interloper announce themselves unless they thought they were going to be, you know, in a superior position, like they, you know, that they were bigger or more confident?
Yeah, you know, I don't understand that either, and I've seen it with pheasants outside of a turkey stand. I was hunting turkeys, but it was also ringneck pheasant season, and they were doing the same thing. As soon as a rooster would land in another rooster's territory, he would immediately announce himself. And I'm like, if you would have just landed and been quiet, I don't think that guy would have run over there, because the rooster I was watching immediately stormed over to where that other rooster landed and made a call. And so I think for whatever user, and it's just more advantageous for them to announce themselves right away and almost like get over the confrontation. Or they are really enticing the other male to see if indeed they are superior or if they should leave and they pick the wrong fight.
I see. So they don't want to invest too much energy in if mm-mm. they find out that they're not even going to be close to being dominant mm-hmm. in the area.
So they call the other one out of hiding to see how big it is.
Wow. Yeah. So should we hear a yodel
then?
They're
not afraid. Yeah.
Okay. Here's what I have. Maybe I should try this other one, the louder yodel.
That last one is the one we're a little bit more used to interpreting.
It's still going. He just can't stop him or herself. So I'm going to fade that one down and get your take on that. There's a lot of urgency in that louder, faster-paced last one. That seems like more than announcing that you're present.
Yeah, it can, I guess, apparently be used if males see a predator. But typically we have talked about it in terms of this, what I call soliciting at night for their territory. The males will actually kind of crouch their head lower to the water and then extend their neck back, kind of like a penguin dance. And maybe since it's dark and no one could actually see the loon do that, it's more helpful for, you know, to project that sound.
Right.
But yeah, Dr. Peruk also did talk about that when those three repeating patterns get closer together and they get louder, that means that there is some sense of urgency there. Likely a threat is around. But I don't know how close the threat has to be or how long the loon will go on. You know, those details, I really don't know.
So the alarm signal could be rung by either sex parent, mom or dad?
That yodel, that last one, is just a male.
Just a male. Okay. The female has other things that she would do if she needed to sound the alarm? Or does she stay quiet and take the young away while the male does that?
Well, I think if it was during the day, the female could make the tremolo, which is the alarm call for threatening situations. So it sounds like these calls, though, you know, they do have multiple purposes, and that's where I was kind of mentioning that context is really important, which we can't always predict or know what they're picking up on. I think it'd be really cool, though, to extend this conversation to other animals as well and what they use for alarm calls. I was listening and reading about other animals and their alarm calls and how there are certain squirrels and prairie dogs who have very certain calls for very certain predators, and how other animals, like I had mentioned, those corvids, they pick up on that, so they also know how to kind of read the environment, per se.
Their calls might actually be customized to the nature of the threat. Like there's a call for bear versus wolf versus...
Yes. And they even think there's a difference between big, like something like big snake or new snake versus small red snake, that there is kind of an order or grammar, shall you say, to some of these alarm calls in some animals, that when they're out of order, the animal does not respond the way that it does if the calls were in the correct order.
Right. So it takes a lot of observational opportunities. Mm-hmm. A sampling size has to be pretty high so you can start making clear associations of the grammar. Trying to get a glossary of the grammar of these various organisms is a time-consuming thing. Can you remind us again about the loon expert, Dr. Peruk, that you're referring to and what his work is?
Sure.
About?
So Dr. Peruk he's a loon scientist that's worked all over the United States doing long-term studies, a lot about loon migration, where they go throughout the year. He was kind of traveling this last summer about his work. And, you know, I should know where
where he's out of?
From, but he's been all over the United States and, studying loons.
Yeah,
in Canada,
I was bringing him up because I was intrigued as to whether somebody has written something that might not just be an academic treatise, but some book of general knowledge about loons that might be worthy of people checking out.
Yes, it is. And I have his book in front of me. It's called Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver by author James D. Peruke. And so, yeah, he does talk about the calls. Clearly, I've not finished this book yet because I don't know all the details.
Right.
But it is a really well-written book that anyone can pick up, just kind of getting in the world of loons. And
wonderful.
So once I finish this book, I'll definitely know a lot more.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, I don't want to put you on the spot, as we head into the end of August, into the period where we're going to be soon enough seeing cool overnights and leaf changes, when we expect our Northern Lakes loons to be packing up and heading south, what is there a progression of who goes first and when that actually even starts? I think we touched on it in our first interview, but I'm just curious as to how long they'll hang in there and whether it varies greatly depending upon what the weather gives us.
That's a great question. I don't know the variability in year to year. From what I remember, females will tend to leave a little bit earlier. They can fly the farthest since they are the smallest bodied sex. Then males will leave. So I think females will leave sometime in September typically. Males will leave probably into mid-late September, and then juveniles will typically wait until October or late September to leave because they want as much time to build up their body.
Right.
And get enough food for their first migration. And they may not return for up to 2 or 3 years after their first migration. They can stay in the Gulf for a while, learn how to be a loon down in the ocean
right
before they come back.
Battling the waves a bit and getting stronger. Yeah, I see.
Yeah, learning how to not get sick in the waves.
It applies. It's something that all of us who are on big bodies of water need to get adapted to. So can you remind us again? I think we're up against the clock a bit, Michaela. It's really been fun visiting about loon vocalizations. Again, could you give us the name of Dr. James Peruke's book on the loon again for folks that want to dive in a little deeper, so to speak?
Yeah, it's called Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver.
I think that's winter's coming up and people can do some reading
it's
about
the first
our state
on my,
bird.
My winter list, yeah.
Yeah. I thank you for joining us today. I hope other people enjoyed that. I didn't pierce too many ears with loon calls. Fun having you on the phone, but it'll be fun to see you in person in a couple of weeks, and hopefully we'll be talking about some of those early autumn or late summer phenomena. A lot of things still happening phenology-wise. So,
all right. Well, I look forward to it, Leo. Thanks for having me.
Great. We'll see you on the radio. Thanks again, Michaela.
Okay.
Bye now.
Sure.
This is Michaela Rice, naturalist at Gooseberry Falls State Park here on the North Shore, who joins us every couple of weeks for Wandering Nature News. This is Leo for KTWH.